by your grace, use them to your glory. Amen. I'm just going to pause a minute. Great. Okay. Great. I might just carry on from where I'm at, actually, if that's okay. Is that right? If we're going to talk about risk, I think we had probably better start by thinking about what it is. We can define risk as danger or exposure to the possibility of loss, to injury, or other adverse circumstances. And under this definition, all life is risky, whether you're a Christian or whether you are not. As Bilbo Baggins says in Lord of the Rings, it's a dangerous business, Frodo, going out of your front door. Because life will involve loss, injury, or adverse conditions in some form. And I think probably everyone here this morning has had times of hardship or suffering, sickness or loss. So we can nuance this definition by saying that risk is a combination of the likelihood of an adverse circumstance and the consequences. It's a combination of the likelihood of an adverse circumstance and the consequences. Our family go rock climbing. I think it's fair to say that there is a variety of abilities, and mine is not at the top. And if we go scrambling, which is effectively going up a steep slope where you have to use your hands a bit and you're not roped it in, then there's a reasonable chance of you slipping. But the consequences are fairly minor. Bruises, grazes at the most. The risk is low. If we were to go rock climbing on something steeper and didn't use ropes, there's a much higher chance of falling, and the consequences could be substantially greater. Broken bones. The risk is quite high. So we do use ropes, and the likelihood of us falling drops to almost nil, and the risk is low. But what about if we were to climb the famous El Capitan rock formation? 3,000 vertical feet of sheer rock granite in California, and were to use ropes. The likelihood of me falling is 100%, but the consequences are going to be quite minor if I'm roped in. If truth be known, the consequences of me hurting myself if I wasn't roped in a fairly minor, because on El Capitan, I would only be about a foot off the ground. Either way, the risk is quite low. But if you're one of the climbers who free solo, who climbs without ropes on El Capitan, the likelihood of falling is really high, and the consequences would almost certainly be fatal. Which is why nobody had climbed it without ropes until 2017. And then only after he had practiced it over 50 times. And even with all that practice, the risk is substantial. So risk when climbing is the combination of the likelihood of falling combined with the consequences of that fall. And we can choose to scramble or to climb, to use ropes, or to go free solo, to practice again and again, or maybe instead forego climbing altogether and have a cup of tea in front of the fire. But by making these choices, we can increase or decrease the risk. Life will undoubtedly involve loss, injury, and adverse conditions, but is it risky? And as we look at the story of Noah this morning, I want to suggest that our experience of life and its consequences will depend on the choices we make. So let's turn to chapter 6 of Genesis, the first of four chapters that tell the story of Noah. And in verse 11, we find that the world is described as corrupt and filled with violence in God's sight. In Genesis chapter 1, the Creator God made the world and saw everything he had made, and indeed it was very good. And now he looks at everything that he had made and sees that it is no longer very good. And the reason for this change is the behavior of the people that he created. It began in Genesis 3 when Eve sees something that is good and takes it, regardless of the clear limits God had put in place. And we see the same thing happening here in verse 2, as again people see something that they think is good and take it without reference to God. I imagine they were enjoying themselves and that life seemed to be going well and they didn't feel they needed God, or maybe they didn't want to live within his boundaries. But verse 5 says that the wickedness of mankind was great and that every inclination of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil all the time. I don't think this is necessarily saying that these people were particularly nasty. Rather, that it was emphasizing that their lives were founded on what they wanted and not the good life as God had created them to live. They're living without any reference to God, their creator and sustainer. As Rob's already mentioned, this week, Christians all over the world are praying, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as in heaven." And in contrast here, we see people who are effectively saying, "My kingdom come, my will be done on earth." And gradually, this approach to life changes the world until here it's described as corrupt and violent. The good, creative, and ordering work that we see God doing in Genesis 1 is being reversed by people, and the world is descending into chaos and destruction. Until in verse 6, we have what I think is probably one of the most poignant verses in the Bible. "The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain." And so here we see in God an extraordinary mix of sovereignty and intimacy, of power and of love. The Creator God who loves the world he made and who grieves over the way it is being corrupted and destroyed. And rather than seeing it being destroyed, he would rather destroy it because he's sorry he's made it. It is no longer the good world he made. And he mourns over it. However, in Noah, he finds something different. And in verse 18, God makes the first covenant with his people, a promise of salvation that starts here with one person, Noah, then his family, and then will extend beyond to the whole human race and all of created life. The promise that there will be a renewed world after the flood. The God who is both powerful, who is sovereign, makes the first move in the salvation of the earth. And over the next three chapters, he communicates and directs and provides. And he's not only concerned with the big picture of the whole earth being restored and renewed, but also the details of one man and his family, providing a way to safety, shutting them in as the rain comes, and calling them out as dry land appears. So what is it about Noah that makes his experience of this corrupt and violent world so different from that of everyone else? What is it that means he finds favour in God's sight? How does he respond to what's happening in the world? I think the first thing to notice is that Noah is living in the same world as everyone else. There's no suggestion here that he's living in a special bubble that shields him from everything that's happening in the world, the corruption and the violence. And in fact, when you're building an enormous wooden structure that seems to have no purpose, one could argue that you're going to have a considerably harder time. He experiences the flood, the destruction of the earth, albeit with a very different outcome from everyone else. His difference doesn't come from his circumstances, but how he lives within those circumstances. So Noah is described in verse 9 as righteous and blameless, not just a description of his character, but a description of the choices he makes, because in the second half of verse 9 it says, he walks with God. And as everyone else follows their own desires and does their own thing while ignoring God, Noah walks with him. Later on in the Bible, Jesus is asked what the greatest commandment is, and he says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the greatest and first commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. The first half of this, love the Lord your God, is Godward, and the second half, love your neighbor, is manward. And these verses could describe Noah. He is described as blameless, a Godward verb, relating in the right way to God, and righteous, which is a manward verb, relating in the right way with others. And he can do this because he walks with God. He goes the way God goes. And if you are in a situation that is corrupt and violent and are trying to navigate your way through successfully, surely it is good to walk with the creator of the universe who knows what good looks like, who knows how it's meant to work. Noah also listens to God. God speaks and Noah listens, and so receives some remarkably detailed instructions here about how to build an ark and what you put in it. And whilst others are listening to the thoughts of their hearts to guide them, Noah was listening to God. And then, remarkably, given what he's just heard, Noah obeys God. In verse 22, after God giving all the details of how to build the ark, we read, Noah did this. He did all that God commanded him. He didn't listen to God and decide that given the circumstances and what he could see around him, it might work and he might go along with it. Rather, you get the feeling with Noah that he walked with God as a way of doing things, a way of living. And therefore, when God spoke, he obeyed, because that's what you did when God spoke. Hebrews 11 has a list of people of great faith who trust.